Hey guys, I'm Paul Bates and this is the Fermentation Podcast. Join me on this journey to put fermentation into practice, create culture, and revive this lost art that connects all of us to our cultures of the past. Today is Friday, October 24th, 2014. We're getting very close to Halloween and the kiddies trick-or-treating. This is episode number 11. Today is kind of a different sort of a show. At the beginning, I throw in, you know, some of the emails and some of the comments I've been getting from listeners and then, you know, reply to some of those. And then I go over some of the posts I've been making out the website, really cool with lots of pictures, recipes, a lot of how-tos and just general knowledge on different things like food safety. So it's definitely a different kind of a show. I go over a recipe for the basic fermented cashew cheese, which is very tasty. I'm going to make some more of that pretty soon. And then I go over an entire post on mold and food safety, which is very cool. But before that, all the topics and links for today's show will be in the show notes at fermentationpodcast.com. If you'd like to get a hold of me, email me at paul@fermentationpodcast.com or just go to the website and click on the contact button on the top. You can also connect to me on Facebook, Pinterest, YouTube, and Twitter. Just go to fermentationpodcast.com and you should see the links in the sidebar. Also, if you'd like to be a guest on the show, just head out to the website, click on the guest button on top. There's a guest submission form that I have there, you know, you can fill out. And of course, you know, I always welcome any emails that you send me, whether it's questions or comments or suggestions, anything that you send me, I see everything. All right, so before I get into everything I was going to talk about today, you know, having to do with mold and food safety and listener feedback, and I just wanted to let you guys know, I actually have quite a few posts over at the website. I know a lot of you just kind of listen to this weekly as it comes out, but take the last episode, episode 10, which was types of salt, brine basics, weight ratios, and fermentation. I actually made quite a long post on making a salt brine and calculating salinity for brine recipes. And I have quite a few things in there. There's the whole list of all the different salts I covered. I have a chart in there that very easily spells it out for you in cups, pints, quarts, gallons. And then below that, you have all the different salt brine ratios from like 1 to 20% and how many grams of salt that's required. And then on Monday, I actually posted a really good recipe for vegan cashew cheese. And that's actually taking cashews and blending them up and then fermenting them with Rejuvelac, which is a fermented grain beverage. And once you leave the cheese there, you can either have like a cheese spread or a solid cheese, which is really cool. I'll go over that later. But with every post, I always try to post a lot of photography also. So, you know, a lot of nice pictures to go along with this. And if you look at the cheese, it'll probably make your mouth water and maybe give you some good ideas for any kind of presentations you want to do with the cheese. And then over the next couple of days, I actually started posting more of like mold and food safety kind of posts. And the mold ones are really interesting because I got really, really up close pictures of the mold. Probably much closer than anything else you would see. I had the lens maybe like 1 millimeter from the mold itself. So it was almost kind of creepy, but I think the pictures speak for itself when you can actually see the little filaments that hold the mold together. So anyways, I figured I'd just let you guys know that, you know, other than the podcast, there's actually a website out there with like tons of pictures, have recipes, and everything I talk about on the show, I put into the website. So get out there, check it out, and then, you know, if you want any kind of updates, just subscribe to it by email. Just click on the subscribe button on top. So the next thing I've been just kind of kicking around is the idea of maybe doing like a listener feedback show of all the emails I get or different messages or questions or whatever. So I figured maybe today I would start the show off with some of the emails I've gotten and kind of respond to those and see if you guys like that. And you know, it's fun for me to get the emails, but it's also kind of cool to actually read some of the comments and things on the air. So this first one comes in from Karen. She says, I discovered the Fermentation Podcast last night and am enthralled with both your content and your presentation. Very much look forward to becoming part of your listening, participating community, starting with pickles this holiday weekend. Much success and thank you, Karen. So that's a pretty cool one. Thank you very much, Karen. I hope your pickles turned out pretty good. And I'd actually be pretty interested to hear maybe some of the recipes that you used or what they actually tasted like. And that actually reminds me, I have a couple jars, I think I mentioned before, I've had a couple jars of pickles on the counter that they turned out really soft, and I've been kind of throwing around the idea of maybe dehydrating them and seeing how that turns out. That might be an interesting experiment. And if I do that, I'll have to let you guys know, you know, how that turned out. And, you know, of course, post pictures and everything, so. All right, the next one comes in from Gucci, who says, "Hi there, I'm a follower, a fan, and a fellow fermentation enthusiast." That's kind of a tongue twister. "I love what you're doing. Please keep up the good work. I'm planning on starting a fermentary of my own in the next few years, and I'll be sure to keep in touch about it. I would like to suggest a podcast topic, aerobic versus anaerobic fermentation and their uses. I think this is a relevant point of coverage for newcomers, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about it as well. Thanks again, Gucci." Well, Gucci, I think that's a pretty good idea, because there's a big difference between aerobic and anaerobic fermentation. And later on in the episode, I'll describe, you know, about mold and how it only grows in aerobic fermentations, and it actually needs oxygen. And anaerobic is more bacteria, yeast. And I think, you know, maybe in an upcoming show, I'll do, or even like an upcoming post, maybe I'll do a post on, say, bacteria versus mold versus yeast versus things that people are scared about, like botulism. What can they survive in? What they, can't they? So maybe like oxygen, temperature, salt, acid. That could be an interesting idea. So I'll have to keep that one in mind. And also, I like the word fermentary. It almost makes me think of, you know, when I see people post pictures of their kitchens or their different areas that they have all their different mason jars and crocks, and having a fermentary of my own. And I know a lot of people that get involved in this, they end up taking huge amounts of counter space. I mean, right now I'm looking over there, I have a 2-gallon container filled with a kombucha SCOBY, and then, you know, the couple pickles and just several other different things here and there, especially like in the refrigerators. So yeah, cool idea having a fermentary. Okay, so the next one comes in from Doug, and he says, "I found your podcast because I really want to focus on something I'm good at to be able to prosper in a SHTF or shit hit the fan scenario. Fermenting would be that. I have been brewing beer for several years now and even won a first prize in a contest. I also lacto-ferment sauerkraut and want to experiment with other fermentables. I listened to the Survival Podcast, and I'm taking the Permaethos PDC right now, and I have listened to your first podcast, and I'm excited to hear the rest. Doug." So from my thoughts on, say, having a, you know, a collapse of the economy or a collapse of the country for any number of reasons, say whether that's an economic collapse due to, I don't know, something like a gold bullion depository not being able to deliver gold, or the derivatives market blowing up, kind of like what happened in 2008 with the Lehman Brothers debacle. And that was only one thing that went wrong that kind of collapsed everything. It was almost like a cascade event. Or, you know, anything else, who knows, solar flare, EMP that people are always freaked out about, which are probably not too likely, you know, we'll always rebuild. But say you're in a scenario where there's no power, there's no running water, and, you know, you have all this food, what are you going to do? And the first thing that always comes to mind is, say the power goes out, like, you know, I live in a hurricane area, so say the power goes out, and I don't have a generator, and you have all this frozen food. First, you just leave everything in the fridge to try to keep it as long as you can. But say, you know, days go by, or even like a couple weeks, you know, can you take everything out of the freezer and then just start to ferment it? Yeah, you definitely can. And I think it's a good idea to learn some of these fermentation methods, because you can have your food last longer and even taste better. And say some of the bulk things that people store, like grains or beans or some of the long-term storables like that, you can even make them healthier. So say you take like a wheat grain, if you were to just chew those up, you'd probably break your teeth and you wouldn't even get all the nutrition out of it. Most of the time you cook it, but, you know, say you could just ferment it and soften it up and turn it into a beverage. Or look at soybeans. Soybeans is an interesting one, because you can't eat them the way they are. And even if you cook them and eat them, you'll probably get terrible gas, or, you know, just a lot of indigestion. But over in the Asian countries, they've learned that you can take kind of like a mold and have that mold pre-digest the soybeans. And that's how you get tempeh, which is a pretty interesting thing, you know, to put on a sandwich or to eat by itself. You can make it taste like so many different things. It's almost like a meat substitute. So yeah, I think fermentation is definitely a good thing that everybody should know. And it was what people just had always known way back then. You know, it was just a way of life. There was no classes, or there was no podcasts on fermentation. It was just a way of life. Everybody made pickles in northern climates. Everybody had their garden and wanted to extend the harvest to the winter. So yeah, learning this stuff is definitely worthwhile. And I think, you know, everybody should be doing it. And when he says in here, you know, he makes sauerkraut and wants to experiment with other fermentables, there's just an unimaginable amount of things that you can make. It's very cool. And he also says, you know, taking the PermaEthos PDC, which is the PermaEthos permaculture design course. I had actually taken my design course with Jeff Lawton of the Permaculture Research Institute of Australia. And that's definitely a cool thing to get into. It gives you like a higher understanding or a broad understanding of just the entire world down to the microbial level, up to the macro level and pattern recognition and all these different types of things. So yeah, thanks for the email, Doug. I think it's definitely a valid thing to know in a SHTF scenario. And just one more thing I wanted to add to that. When he mentioned he won a prize, you know, in a brewing contest, if you're in a long-term grid down scenario, I think being able to brew some beer and maybe some other things would be a good idea to know. And I think alcohol is probably one of the first barter items that always pops up in history and that's always held its value. Everybody always wants some kind of alcohol in a long-term scenario like that. And, you know, I think it's very telling when the government has a bureau that's the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Those are probably your three big barter items right there. So yeah, fermentation is definitely worth knowing. And this next one comes in from Richard, and he says, thanks for the podcast, very thorough and excellent audio. I've been fermenting veggies for several years and would like to tell you about one of my more popular ones. And it's pineapple slices and hot peppers in a salt brine. And I'll make sure to put a link to this recipe in the show notes. But he says the pineapple slices turn out pleasantly hot. And from the recipe, it looks like you can use jalapenos or habaneros or anything like that. So yeah, you'll have to go check that out. And if anybody makes this, let me know. I'll probably be making it fairly soon if I can get some pineapple. So he continues on. Here's my theory on the origin of fermenting. Naturally fermented foods were found and then the process was copied. I think natural fermentation occurred along the ocean from the ocean salt water. Ocean salt water is pretty much the same as used in brining and fermenting, about 3-5%. So it's logical to concur how it was discovered. I used to buy what was called fermented duck's egg. That was an egg that was buried along the seashore for a year. Very good with noodles. Fish, vegetables, fruit were probably laid in natural rock formations that held ocean water. They would have held down the product with rocks and stones, keeping it from spoilage and from critters. I would suggest that salt was highly valued for its use in food preservation and not because of its table uses. I was all ears for the book review of Sally Fallon's work, and I'm very interested in learning more about fermenting grains. For instance, can dried brown rice be fermented? I would like to learn how to make miso. Can other beans be fermented? And talking about fermenting food with others, I've learned that almost everyone has a misconception that fermenting is synonymous with making alcohol. And lastly, the Fermentation Fest held every year in town, not too far from where I live, to be found here. And he gives a link for the fermentationfest.com, which I've seen several other fermentation festivals going on. It'd be kind of cool to go to one of those. But first, I guess talking about the duck egg, that was pretty interesting. I've actually thought as I was sitting on the beach by the ocean about how, you know, the salinity of the sea salt water could probably be used in a brine. That would be pretty interesting to do. I would almost kind of wonder, say if you bury something at the beach, it's in an anaerobic environment. And of course, I guess you don't ferment eggs because they're not really fermented, but you can probably salt cure them. You probably salt cure a lot of things. I would almost think that burying something, it sounds like an interesting idea, but I just kind of wonder, say you bury something at the beach. Beach sand is probably a fairly large particle. So I would think as the water comes in and moves out slowly underground, there's somewhat of like a seepage. So I would almost think that maybe all of the bacteria that would be fermenting that would probably be washed away. And then maybe you would end up more with like a salt curing kind of a process. That'd be an interesting experiment to try, though. And it probably was a lot of people that live by oceans that probably dabbled in fermentation. I mean, I know northern climates, people did, but I guess when you're by an ocean, you have a ready supply of salt right there. You don't need to mine for it. You could just use ocean water. And I'm sure a lot of people probably did in history, but maybe, you know, we have to do some more experiments nowadays to see how that turns out. That'd be kind of a cool idea. I know a lot of the sea salt I get, is probably either from evaporated seawater. So it's pretty much the same thing. So anyways, yeah, interesting idea. And I'll also be sure to check out that, you know, recipe for the pineapple slices and hot peppers and a salt brine. It sounds really good. And on your question about, you know, can dried brown rice be fermented? Any grains can be fermented. You just need something to get it going. So I think I've seen in Sandra Katz's book, there's different beverages that you can make. And I know when you take brown rice or even white rice, you could probably make sake out of it, which is alcohol. But I'm sure there are other recipes out there that you can use for that, you know, to make something that's not so alcoholic. But yeah, you definitely can ferment any grains. You just need the medium or the culture to get it going. And in Asian countries, it's I think they use something called koji. And on your other question, you know, learn how to make miso and can other beans be fermented? Anything can be fermented. I guess it just depends on the taste you're looking for and, you know, what you want it to be. Like I was saying earlier on another email about you can ferment soybeans and using mold to do that. And they actually pre-digest the bean into a solid mass. So yeah, some interesting ideas. And, you know, of course I encourage you to get out and try some of these and report back. Let me know how it goes. So let's take another one. All right, so the next one comes in from John, and he says, Paul, I think your podcast timing is good because of the interest in the microbiome diet, which is just eating fermented foods to keep your gut bacteria happy and healthy. I've been a fermenter for a long time, and I've never seen so many interested in fermentation and how to do it. I'm a 76-year-old man and a vegetarian for over 30 years. I'm in very good health, no medications at all. Walk every day, eat fermented veggies every day, and laugh a lot. I look forward to your next podcast, John. That is pretty awesome. I mean, if that's like a testament to somebody living a healthy life, you know, a 76-year-old guy who can still get out, walk every day, and, you know, on top of that, not taking any medications, which is seems very rare today to have some of our older generation, you know, they're usually on bags full of pills, you know, pills for the side effects of the other pills. So yeah, I think eating fermented vegetables or, you know, eating fermented foods on a regular basis, it's a great way to just give yourself a little bit of a health boost, you know, a tiny maintenance kind of a thing. Like I said before, like having a cup of herbal tea, you know, it's not a cure for anything, but it's just part of a great healthy diet. And this idea of a microbiome diet, that's kind of interesting also, where you're just eating things, trying to make the different colonies in your intestines and your digestive system work a little bit healthier. So yeah, very cool. And I'm definitely looking forward to hearing more from John, you know, in his 80s or 90s. That would be very cool to have somebody that's, you know, that's still out there living a great life and healthy at that older age. Very cool. And this next one comes in from Gary. And Gary says, Paul, your interview with Ariana was first class. It will be a hard act to follow. Yeah, she was definitely a pretty good interview. And he says, I've admired the work you've done on the site and the podcast. I got interested in fermentation after listening to the Dr. Axe podcast with guest Jenny Magruder. Would be great if you could land her on your podcast one day. Then I stumbled onto your site. I've got to say, this is where I should have begun. I enjoy the way you keep things easy to understand. I also appreciate the fact you have a family podcast, not something you can't listen to in front of the kids. I guess maybe I said a word in this one, which, you know, not that big a deal to me, but I try to keep it, you know, slightly clean. I'm anxious for you to become profitable in the dollar and spiritual reward. I'll keep listening. A question. I've got a ginger bug and it seems to be doing fine. I've even stumbled through a couple batches of ginger ale. My question is, when adding the bug, which is half a cup to 1 quart of ginger and sugar water, do you just add the liquid or the entire slurry? And as you use the bug and maintain it with the new ginger and sugar, do you also add more water? Stupid question, I know. You're welcome to use any of the question remarks on the show without credit, Gary. And he says, P.S., how about merchandising some specialty fermentation items such as vessels, airlocks, funnels, sieves, tattler lids, cultures, etc.? So as far as the question of when adding the ginger bug, do I add the entire thing, you know, the liquid along with all the ginger particles and the ginger chunks, do I add the entire thing or just the liquid? And so whenever I'm doing it, I just kind of sieve all the liquid. So I sieve the liquid ginger bug into the batch that I'm going to be fermenting. So then I don't have to fish out all the chunks later on. And as far as the other question, as I use the ginger bug and maintain it with new ginger and sugar, do you also add more water? So a lot of times, if I'm making a big batch, I might even use like a fourth to a half of the whole jar of ginger bug. And when I add new ginger, so maybe, you know, a teaspoon, a tablespoon of fresh chopped ginger, and maybe a teaspoon or tablespoon of sugar to it, I just fill the jar all the way back up to the top. And then, you know, just add more as I need to. So that's what I do, and I think that's worked pretty well for me. As far as the question on merchandising some specialty fermentation items, like the vessels, airlocks, funnels, you know, all kinds of fermentation equipment, I think I've had some of those ideas, and I kind of tossed around the idea of maybe making like a member section to where I wouldn't be selling this stuff, but if I had sponsors that were very interested in this idea, maybe I could either get them to sponsor the show. You know, I would mention them. I would have maybe like a rotating sponsorship, and maybe for members that actually pay to sponsor the show and they become a member, maybe I would probably get sponsors or fermentation companies that say sell cultures or say sell fermentation equipment. Maybe they could actually give my members discounts. So only the people that are truly interested in fermentation and are willing to spend money on things, I think that would be a highly targeted audience for companies. And at the same time, the members would be getting a discount on things that they would be buying anyway. So I've tossed around ideas like that. But yeah, I definitely appreciate, you know, some of the comments and some of the thoughts you have on that. And I appreciate the email. Good luck with the ginger ale. And I'm sure probably by now you've already like finished it and drank the whole thing and maybe even made a couple more batches. But thanks for the email. And lastly, I actually have one more email from Gary. And it looks like he's actually been pretty busy in the fermenting of different things, which is pretty cool. He says, on Wednesday, October 8th, I started two batches of sauerkraut. One was shredded cabbage, layered with the prescribed sea salt, along with the Berkey filtered water. The other was cabbage and julienne carrots with the same salt water brine. I pounded both batches and weighted them with glass weights in 1-quart mason jars fitted with airlocks. I haven't had a bubble out of either jar. Today is October 13th, so that's about 5 days. Am I too anxious? It's about 79 degrees in my laundry room, and they're in a dark corner. The head of cabbage was from Whole Foods and sold as organic. Gary. So on this one, I had actually already written him back and told him, after 5 days, you should probably see bubbles on this. But, you know, sometimes the bubbles aren't too obvious. Say you have a ferment that's going along, and you don't see any bubbles right away. If you kind of tap the jar or maybe even just stir it a little bit or press down a little bit on it, you'll probably see some of those bubbles come up. And, you know, sometimes in sauerkraut, I would do it for maybe 2 weeks or so before I think it's actually pretty good. And it's a very, very good idea to add that airlock on there. So then you don't have to worry about oxygen getting in there and, you know, mold forming. And later he actually did write back and said he tasted those two sauerkraut batches and they seem to be coming along nicely. And also he has a 1/2 gallon of hard cider foaming, which is very cool. He also looks forward to hearing episode 9, which I had already put out with Mark Campbell. Yeah, it's very cool to get some of these emails of people actually getting out there and trying some of this stuff and, you know, some of the questions that they might be having. So anyway, I guess, you know, I'll wrap on the listener feedback segment. You have to give me some feedback. Let me know. You have to write in or comment or whatever. Just letting me know, do you like this section? Do you want me to keep it in there? As I keep getting emails, you know, would you like to hear them on the air? Yeah, I appreciate all the contact you guys have been giving me on, say, Facebook and on Pinterest, and then a lot of the emails that have come through my email box. Very cool to see that. And, you know, if you want to reply to anybody's comments or emails, you know, you can just put them in the show notes at the website. And, you know, they'll see them from there. All right, so to get into the other parts of the show for today, I wanted to go over a little bit of that recipe that I had done for the vegan cashew cheese. It was actually pretty cool. You know, I've seen a lot of recipes out there for cashew cheese, and this was probably made popular by a woman named Miyoko Skinner of the cookbook Artisan Vegan Cheese. And the idea of it is not too foreign from regular cheese making. I mean, if you think about regular milk, milk is like a liquid fat. And say you take cashews and blend them up in water, then you also have like a liquid fat. And then when you add Rejuvelac, which is the fermented grain beverage, and let it sit for like a few days, it kind of gets that sour taste, and I'm sure the bacteria in there multiply the same way as they do in cheese. But anyway, you know, just an overview, what I did, I took, you know, some cashews, blended them up with water, added the Rejuvelac, added nutritional yeast, which is just a deactivated kind of a yeast that grows on sugar cane or molasses. And then I also added lemon juice. Then I let it sit out for a couple days just to get that tanginess that I wanted, that, you know, cheese kind of is known for. And then I took wax paper and tried to spoon the cashew cheese onto it to make somewhat of like a log. And it was kind of tricky to do, but I'm sure with practice, it'll probably get a little bit easier. And then I just tied both ends off and put it in the fridge. And after about 2 days, you can see from the pictures on the website, it almost looks like it kind of shrank as it set. And then after I took it out there, when I cut into it, it was still very soft in the middle, but the outside, you could tell, was just a little bit harder. And I took that to a family gathering, and people kind of cut into it, put it on crackers, and they thought it tasted just as good as cheese did. So it was kind of exciting. I took about half of it home, and I put it in the fridge for another like 1 to 2 weeks. I think it was about 2 weeks later. And when I took it out, it was solid. So it completely set into a solid mass of cashew cheese that then you can very much slice. And I had a little piece left. I kept it for maybe another couple weeks in the fridge. And then it was like very solid, where you can almost grate it like Parmesan. So I think there could be a lot of good ideas from this basic cashew cheese recipe. And some of those ideas I've thought about is maybe you can add other ingredients rather than just having a plain cheese like I did. I only had nutritional yeast and lemon juice to give it a tiny bit of a flavoring. But maybe if I took some of my pickled peppers and added those in there, chopped them up, maybe it'll turn into more like a pepper jack. Or if you could add sun-dried tomatoes and herbs, or minced garlic, olives, miso paste, onions. Other people have told me maybe chop walnuts or other kind of nuts, or dried fruit like apricots or chopped cherries, and maybe even citrus rind. And probably the weirdest idea I heard was cacao nibs, which is like chocolate beans. And I guess, you know, maybe that could be an interesting savory taste, adding chocolate to cheese, because I know they go well together anyway, being both fermented goodies that people like to bring to parties. Some ideas for herbs to add to this. You can either add it inside or roll the log. Or, you know, if you form it into balls, you can make cheese balls. So say if you have a cheese ball or a log, you can roll it in like Italian herbs or dill or parsley or chives, rosemary, paprika, cumin, cracked black pepper, crushed red pepper. Or if you want to get into even more interesting ideas to make it totally different, maybe you could add liquid smoke to make more of like a smoky cheese. Or add apple cider vinegar, Dijon mustard. If you want it different colors, to say if you're making more like a sharp kind of a cheddar flavor, if you can get that, maybe add some carrots or turmeric in there to change the color, coconut oil for a different mouthfeel. Or instead of even using Rejuvelac, which all the recipes I see use Rejuvelac, but I've also heard people use, say, sauerkraut juice or fermenting it with like a yogurt instead of the Rejuvelac. And that actually works really well. And I'm sure it tastes a little different than, you know, using Rejuvelac. So a lot of very cool ideas. And, you know, on top of that, maybe not even using cashews, maybe using a different kind of a nut. But I think cashews have such a mild flavor, you can make it taste like a lot of different things. Whereas if you would try walnuts or pecans or one of those, or hazelnuts, you know, I'm sure it has such a sharp flavor. Those type of nuts, you probably can't make it taste like much else. But, you know, you never know. Always open to ideas. So next up, early in the week, I had also made a post about mold in my pickled peppers. And the story behind that, I went to the farmer's market one week and I picked up some, you know, a couple batches of jalapenos. And normally, you know, I just make regular pickled jalapeno peppers, and then I put them on sandwiches, or I put them on Indian dishes, and, you know, just enjoy them like that. So anyway, I follow the normal recipe like I normally do and ferment them for about 3 days. And then I just put them in the fridge because normally they're done. And this is actually the second refrigerator, the one that's out in the garage. So I was in there maybe like a few weeks or a month after that, and I was in there getting something else in the fridge, and I noticed a little bit of color on top of the pickled peppers. And I'm thinking to myself, like, oh my God, there's actually mold, you know, for the first time. So there was just a little spot of mold. So I thought to myself, all right, well, I'll test this. You know, I took the jar out, and it was, at first it was only one jar. Took the jar out, took the little bit of mold, you know, threw it away, put it back in, no big deal. And then probably another couple weeks to a few weeks later, In the fridge again, and I noticed the same color has come back. You know, I see the mold in there again, and I'm thinking, oh, wow. So I just kind of let it go, thinking, you know, oh, I'll get to it later, or maybe I'll do something with it or experiment or something. So anyway, a little time went by. I went back into the fridge, and I thought, oh, I should get a picture of this. So I took the jars out of the fridge. One of them had mold that was slightly white in color and almost on the way turning green, and the other one had a very, like, much older looking dark green carpet of mold on it. And at first thought, you know, I kind of cringed at it. Your first reaction is like, man, you got to throw that stuff away. So I set the pickles on the counter. I get out all the camera gear, you know, the tripod, the macro lenses, the accessories, and I start setting this up and taking a few pictures of it. And the closer I get to it, I'm thinking like, wow, this is pretty amazing looking. This looks a lot different than I was expecting. And in a way, I can almost say it's like almost beautiful looking. So anyway, long story short, I made a whole post on it. You know, what did I do? What was the verdict? Did I keep it and skim the mold off, or did I throw it away? And the verdict was it looked just like a little bit too much mold. And I first flipped the mold over to see what was on the bottom and took pictures of that just to give an idea of what it looks like from all sides. And then, you know, for myself, I just decided, yeah, I'll go ahead and throw it away. I have a banana circle outside, so I joke that I fed it to my bananas. And a banana circle, for those who don't know, it's a very classic permaculture technique where you dig a pit, maybe like a few feet deep, take the dirt out and mound it up into a donut, and then you plant banana trees into the donut, and then into the middle where you just dug the pit, you actually put mulch, leaves, food scraps, anything, you know, any organic kind of material that you put in there. And it's just like a giant compost pile that the banana circle, they just eat. And you keep having to pile more and more stuff onto it because the bananas just keep on sucking all that stuff up. And I have, you know, giant banana trees, tons of bananas on there. We've been eating them for probably about a month now. So anyways, I took several pictures of this mold. They're up on the website. They're very, very cool looking. You can see very up close what mold looks like. And probably the closest picture I have, it's maybe an area of the size of like a tenth of a dime. So very close. And you can actually see the filaments that hold the mold together called hyphae, which also allow the mold to spread. And that's how it kind of branches out across the top of the surface of the water. So anyways, that whole thing got me thinking, oh, I should do a post on this. You know, some of the questions I normally get about mold and food safety. So what I came up with on some of the questions was, what is mold and why is there mold on top of my sauerkraut, pickles, etc.? Is it harmful or dangerous to eat mold and what can it do to you? Is it safe to scrape mold off the surface of a brine and then eat the ferment that's below the brine level? And aren't you afraid of mycotoxins, and doesn't mold have roots, like you probably always hear? And lastly, how can I prevent mold from growing in my ferment, and what do I do now that I have it? And on that post, that's the one where I actually posted the very, very close pictures of the mold, and you can see the fruiting bodies where the spores are actually created. So for the first one, you know, what is mold and why is it growing on my ferment? And mold grows from mold spores that are all around us. They're present everywhere. They're just nearly impossible to get rid of. It's just a part of life. You know, unless you're HEPA filtering your house, you're not going to get rid of them. You just live with them. We've just kind of evolved alongside them. They're a very important part of nature, and just learning about them and learning their habits, learning their environment is pretty important, especially if you live in more of like a human area where mold can become a problem for a lot of people. So anyways, mold spores, they'll land on a wet surface that have nutrients, and then they just start to multiply. And they grow these little filaments called hyphae that connect the mold together. And they're little tiny strands like the, you know, like a spider web. And the mold spores range in size anywhere between 3 and 40 microns, depending on, you know, where you do a Google search on. But it's, you know, about that size. 40 microns is about the limit of what a human eye can see. So if you have some of the larger spores of mold, you might be able to see it, but more than likely you probably need a microscope or a very powerful photograph of a, you know, a macro shot. And in the post, I put up a chart showing the different particle sizes compared to mold, just, you know, so you can get an idea. So in microns, 1 inch is a little over 25,000 microns. The eye of a needle is 1,200. Water mist is 70 to 350. Human hair, 17 to 180. pollen is about 60 microns. Mold spores are between 3 and 40, and red blood cells are between 5 and 10. So they can be about the size of red blood cells, which are pretty tiny. And then even tinier than that, just for reference, is spider webs, measuring in at about 2 to 3 microns. So the first thing, you would really just want to ask yourself, do you actually have mold, or do you have what's called comm yeast, which is like a white, almost powdery film across the top? And most of the time, people just have comm yeast, which you can just scrape off the top. And the only thing that it really does is it just kind of maybe affects the flavor negatively. So if you want a good tasting ferment, you know, make sure to remove that. But if you actually have mold, some of the contributing factors I put in this post are keep it below the brine level. I mean, that's probably the biggest thing. You want an anaerobic environment. As soon as you have a vegetable or your ferment pops up above the brine level, then it's in the oxygen-rich environment, especially if you don't have an airlock. Other things that could contribute to that would be starting with rotten vegetables, which is possible, and it's kind of a clue, I think, maybe what happened to mine. I got those peppers at the farmer's market, but I kind of procrastinated. You know, usually I'll do it within like a couple days, you know, ferment it. But this one, I think I waited about a couple weeks. Some of them were already starting to break down. And I'm guessing it probably is just more susceptible. It probably had more likelihood that mold spores were growing on it already. And then when I fermented it, they just maybe outcompeted some of the other bacteria or were on par with them and were just more likely to grow. And the reason I have that clue is because both jars got it. No other jars I've ever have gotten mold like that. Another contributing factor would be warmer temperatures. So normally if you were fermenting something, it would be in the range between 65 and 70 degrees, maybe even 72. The warmer that you go, you're more likely to get mold. Not guaranteed, but it's just more likely. Salt's another contributing factor. The more salt you have, the little bit less likely, you know, you're going to get mold. Another thing would be chemicals or pesticides that are on the vegetable matter that you're starting with. If you have chemicals or pesticides, or even using water that has chlorine in it, maybe you're killing off all the bacteria that would normally take up residence in that ferment, and then it gives rise to the mold that takes the place. And the next question I cover is it harmful or dangerous to eat mold, and what can it do to you? And I just go over the three ways molds can, you know, make a person sick or infect them. And the three ways are molds can infect somebody. So like athlete's foot kind of thing. Another one would be allergic reactions to the actual mold or mold spores. And the other one is the chemical toxicity, which a lot of people are always afraid of, like mycotoxins. And that's the chemicals or the substances, like the tiny molecules of toxins that the hyphae of the molds form. So when referring to mold, they actually create some of the most powerful toxins that we can come into contact with. So it's definitely not something to mess around with when you're talking about, you know, food and mold. And it might actually take quite a while to get over, you know, any kind of mold poisoning. Which leads me to the next question of, is it safe to scrape mold off the surface of a brine and then eat the ferment that's below the brine level? And in prefacing this question, I just have to say, you know, each person has to decide for themselves, you know, what's appropriate for them. Anecdotally, you know, I've always heard, like in Sandra Katz's book, The Art of Fermentation and Wild Fermentation, you know, he says, if you have mold on the top and all the ferment is below the brine level, just scrape the top off and everything underneath the brine level is fine. So, you know, I can't make any recommendations for anybody, but I can just tell you, you know, some of my own thoughts for myself. So for me, you know, if I have a little bit of mold, I usually just scrape it off or, you know, cut off the piece that's kind of moldy, throw it away, and, you know, just kind of go on with my life. But, you know, like in these pictures, if there's a huge amount of mold or if I just don't feel comfortable with it, I'll just, you know, chuck the whole batch. And it's not a big deal. You know, you can always make more. It's just vegetables. And on the next question, aren't you afraid of mycotoxins and doesn't mold have roots? Which you hear all the time on blogs, on posts, you know, in forums. And, you know, when it comes to mycotoxins, I can't say personally that I've experience any adverse health reactions, you know, to mycotoxins that I'm aware of. And, you know, I've been fermenting for a little while now. And when it comes to, you know, mold having roots, and everywhere I've looked, you know, when it's talking about mold having roots, it always seems to be in an aerobic environment. So say you have a piece of bread laying on the counter and it gets moldy, just like, you know, I've learned in permaculture with a compost pile, or say you go into the forest, if you see a wood pile there and you see mushrooms, those mushrooms haven't just formed right there. They're actually all throughout that wood before you ever see the presence of, you know, the fruiting body, that mushroom itself. And I think the same is true for food in aerobic conditions. But when it comes to anaerobic conditions, you know, I still have questions on that because I can't seem to find anything, even on, you know, the CDC website or the USDA website. They reference mold in food, but never below a brine level, which is an anaerobic environment. And, you know, a lot of people say, oh, mold has roots and warn you it's down into the ferment. I'm not totally convinced of that because I took the pictures, you know, I saw down on the micro level and I have a picture where there's some mold kind of growing into the ferment, but it's only because, you know, it's on the surface. And after a little while, it looks like, so say the young mold had the shoots growing into the brine. But then when you look at the older one, those are completely gone, almost like they couldn't survive. And it's just on top as a solid mass. And when you flip it over, it's completely smooth. There's no hyphae underneath. And, you know, none that I could see with my photographs. So I think, you know, we probably need to get like some high school students on this, making like some kind of a science fair project where they can either get photographs on a smaller scale, trying to find the hyphae or the roots that are actually growing down into an anaerobic brine, or say, you know, you let a ferment go, have it had tons of mold, and then take like an actual brine sample and have it tested to see what the concentration of mycotoxins in the brine are, which I'm not totally convinced that there's going to be a lot. Because another thing I've learned in permaculture is that the function of all these microorganisms, like these bacteria, say you have a compost bin and you have billions and trillions of bacteria in there, their actual function is to break things down and to deactivate toxins. And what they do in a compost bin, say you put, you know, somewhat of toxic chemicals into a compost bin, what they'll actually do is they'll start to break the substances down, and then if they can't quite break it down enough, they'll actually bind them to carbon molecules, which renders them inert. So the same thing for trees. They'll actually take those toxins up into their body, and they're just locked into the tree, locked into the plant's membranes. So I'm almost kind of hypothesizing, you know, whether or not in the fermentation process with these brines, are all of these billions of little bacterias, the lactic acid bacterias, are they actually rendering these mycotoxins inert? Or, you know, is there actually mycotoxin concentrations in there that could make somebody sick? I think there needs to be a lot more research on this because out there on the web, there's absolutely no evidence, no pictures, just anecdotal and nothing that we can actually point to. So I think somebody needs to solve this once and for all so we can kind of go on with our lives. But I can say for myself, if I have a little bit of mold, I'm just going to scrape it off. You know, no big deal. If I have a ton of mold, I'm just going to throw the whole thing away and just not worry about it. But it'd be really cool to actually find this out for sure. And when it comes to the peppers that I made, I actually took a pH strip and tested the acid, and the acid was fine. It was very acidic. So, you know, mold can grow in acid. It just can't grow in an anaerobic environment. So lots of questions still there. And it'd be cool if somebody actually knows this, it'd be cool to put that in the show notes or send me an email or, you know, something that we can look into, like a link somewhere, scientific paper, something like that. That'd be awesome. And then that leads me to the final question is, how can I prevent mold from growing on my ferments? And what do I do now that I have it? And this is almost just the reverse of the first question. You just create an anaerobic environment, something that's free of oxygen. You know, the time-tested method would be to have a vessel with a water moat, you know, like a water moat crock that burps out CO2 and prevents oxygen from entering it. You know, another one coming up is a Krautsource, which is a Kickstarter I'd recently backed. They should be out sometime soon. It's a stainless steel water moat crock that goes on top of a mason jar. But you know, having a water moat crock, that'll probably solve a lot of your problems, or, you know, an airlock. Another thing, which is what I thought kind of spoiled my batch, is using fresher vegetables. Another one would be ferment in slightly colder temperatures, and then maybe use more salt. So those are, you know, some of the ideas of how to try to prevent it. But the biggest one is have an environment that's free of oxygen. But if you already have a mold infestation, what are some of the options? And you really just have three. You can use the old adage, when in doubt, throw it out. Totally acceptable. I do it sometimes. It just happens. The other thing you can do is skim the mold off the top and just don't worry about it. And the last one is skim the mold off the top, and then just try to create a more anaerobic environment for that ferment and maybe ferment it a little bit longer. So you can try any of those. So anyway, I hope you've actually enjoyed this whole episode. You know, I kind of switched it up a little bit. I put the listener feedback, a little bit about some of the posts I've done throughout the week, and then, you know, just covered in detail about mold and food safety. So, of course, everything I covered on today's show will be in the show notes, and I invite you guys to come out to fermentationpodcast.com. Leave me some comments on today's show. You know, let me know what you think. Did you like the listener feedback section? Or, you know, did you have any questions on anything I covered? You know, just put them in the show notes, make some comments, send me an email. Also, don't forget to subscribe to get updates of new shows and blog posts by email. This has been Paul Bates from the Fermentation Podcast, encouraging you to put fermentation into practice, ferment responsibly, and get out there and create some culture.